Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight.
America is finally on the move again.
President Biden welcomes today's jobs numbers. We talk with his chief economic advisor about the challenges ahead as the economy opens up. Then a solemn anniversary. The Tiananmen Square massacre casts a long shadow over modern Chinese politics. We speak with a Communist Party dissident about today's China. Plus, beyond the border, how U.S. agents increasingly drop migrants off in rural areas without resources after their journey from dire circumstances.
There is a lot of conflict. There's no economy. There's no work. There's no way to get ahead. Besides, we're afraid of being in a country where there is great danger for everyone.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart consider negotiations between President Biden and Senate Republicans and the big jobs the president is giving Vice President Kamala Harris. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The pace of hiring in the U.S. picked up last month as many states began easing coronavirus restrictions. The Labor Department reported that employers added 559,000 jobs in May. That was double the number in April. And the unemployment rate fell to 5.8%. In Delaware, President Biden hailed the report as proof his economic plans are working.
No other major economy in the world is growing as fast as ours. No other major economy is gaining jobs as quickly as ours. And none of this success is an accident. It isn't luck.
We'll take a closer look at the jobs report right after the news summary. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention today urged teenagers to get their COVID-19 vaccinations. A new CDC study found hospitalizations of young people were up in March and April, and nearly a third of those patients were admitted to an intensive care unit. Researchers said it may be due to more dangerous virus variants or to school reopenings. Former President Trump will remain suspended from Facebook for 2 years following his role in inciting January's Capitol insurrection. Facebook made the announcement today in response to recommendations from the social media giant's oversight board. Mr. Trump said the suspension is, quote, an insult to the millions of Americans who voted for him in 2020. Former White House counsel Don McGahn testified today before U.S. lawmakers on the Russia investigation and former President Trump's possible obstruction of justice. It was part of an agreement reached last month in federal court. McGahn arrived at the Capitol for a closed-door interview with the House Judiciary Committee more than 2 years after Democrats sought his testimony. A transcript will be released in coming days. Hundreds of people in Hong Kong today defied the police to mark the anniversary of Beijing's 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. Crowds marched and flashed cell phones in Causeway Bay after police had banned a candlelight vigil at a nearby park. Authorities arrested several of the event's organizers.
It is emphasized that it is an offense under the public order ordinance. If anyone take part in or advertise or publicize an unauthorized assembly. The maximum penalty is 5 years imprisonment.
We'll get the perspective of a Chinese political dissident later in the program. Back in this country, President Biden rejected a revised spending offer from Senate Republicans amid efforts to reach an infrastructure deal. He spoke with their lead negotiator, Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia, who proposed an additional $50 billion. But the president said that offer still fell short. The two agreed to speak again on Monday. Fisher-Price is recalling a model of its baby rockers after four infant deaths. The four-in-one rock-and-glide soothers were designed to mimic being rocked in someone's arms. The babies who died were found on their stomachs after being placed on their backs unrestrained. There is word that a forthcoming U.S. intelligence report on UFOs spotted by military pilots has found no evidence of a direct link to aliens. But as the New York Times and others reported, it does not rule out that possibility either. Investigators also said that some of the sightings could have been experimental technology used by other countries. The report is due to go to Congress later this month. And stocks rallied on Wall Street today as the May jobs report boosted confidence in the economy's recovery. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 179 points to close at 34,756. The Nasdaq rose 200 points and the S&P 500 added 37. Still to come on the NewsHour, a Communist Party dissident discusses repression in China on the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. The U.S. Border Patrol increasingly drops off migrants in rural areas without resources. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart break down critical infrastructure negotiations, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We dig in now to today's U.S. jobs report and broader questions about the economy. I spoke a short time ago with Brian Deese. He's the Biden administration's director of the National Economic Council. Brian Deese, welcome back to the NewsHour. Let's talk about that jobs report today. 559,000 jobs created in the month of May. It's twice what we saw in April, but it was still less than what some, if not many, economists had predicted. Does that temper the celebrating Americans should be doing?
I think this job report is really good news for the economy and good news for the American people. We've seen now consistent job growth of about 500,000 jobs a month over the last 4 months, which is the strongest job growth we've seen in quite a long time. In the 3 months prior, we were averaging job growth of about 60,000 a month. So we've seen a significant pickup. And we saw the good news was that that job growth was broad-based across sectors and industries, and also importantly, wages increased. They increased last month, they increased this month again. That's good news for American workers.
Well, let me ask you about the economy broadly speaking, because if you look at all the indicators, still relatively high unemployment rate, even though we know companies are clearly saying they can't find enough workers. Some of them are. You have prices rising for some goods and services, but not for others. You have a supply chain problem. Do you put that together, and does it give you a clear picture of the strength of this economy, or are you as confused as some other people say they are?
Well, I'd start with some perspective. This economy is growing at the fastest rate in nearly 40 years. We saw 6.4% growth in the first quarter, and we're seeing projections now for the year of close to 7%. We haven't seen that type of growth in America for nearly 40 years. You combine that with a solid 500,000 jobs on average growth a month, and you see an economy that's growing strongly, a labor market that's recovering. At the same time, we're in an unprecedented situation. We're coming out of a historic economic crisis and a pandemic. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. There's some dislocation. Certainly, we're seeing demand coming back faster than anticipated in some sectors, and that's creating some supply chain bottlenecks and discontinuities. And so this was never going to be a straight line, and we'll continue to have to work through those issues. But the trend line is clear that the economy is improving rapidly. And we believe that that's, you know, in part based on an economic strategy that the Biden administration is driving and President Biden is driving about how to grow this economy from the bottom up and the middle out.
Well, one of the things that's happening as a result of all this is higher prices. And speaking of that, it's been reported the president made a call in the last few weeks or days to the former Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers, who's been writing opinion pieces expressing his disagreement with the size of the president's what he calls very big plans on jobs, infrastructure, so-called families plan. And also Larry Summers saying he's worried about high prices staying there. Did the president come away from that changing his mind about anything?
I'm not going to speak to private conversations the president had. What I can tell you is where the president is focused and where we are all focused is on driving an economic strategy that is working right now to drive historically strong economic growth, historically strong job growth. We are seeing some temporary dislocations and some temporary price increases, but most of that is being driven in sectors like airlines and hotels and leisure, where we're seeing demand come back from very, very low levels during the pandemic. And so the bottom line here is we've got an economy that's recovering rapidly. We're seeing the Americans are actually finding jobs. Their wages are increasing. That's a good thing. That's a good thing for the American worker. And while there are these short-term mismatches that we think we'll be able to work through, overall, the president has a strategy that is different from his predecessors. That's actually about driving economic growth from the bottom up, making sure that an economy is actually delivering good jobs and wage increases for Americans broadly. We think that strategy is working, and we think that we can double down on that now by investing for the long term.
Well, one of the things that Larry Summers and frankly some Republicans are saying is that instead of spending new government money on the president's ambitious plans, he ought to take some of the unspent COVID stimulus money. Is that something the president's looking at?
Well, I'm glad you raised that issue because it goes to the core of where is that money that we invest, that we're investing from the rescue plan actually going? First, it went out in direct checks to American families. A lot of the reason why there's more demand and more optimism, frankly, among the American people is because 167 million checks, $1,400 checks went out to people. Another place it's going is to schools. One of the things we saw in this month's job report, 100,000 new education jobs at the state and local level, in part because we invested in schools and getting schools open. Teachers are getting back on the job, schools are open, that gives parents more flexibility. We're investing in child care centers so that we can create more child care options for parents as they go back to work. In each of these areas, they're connected to real tangible needs that our economy needs. And it's a plan that was designed to keep this support going because this wasn't going to be a straight line and we're going to have some bumps in the road. So we're very confident that these are resources that are doing a lot of good for the economy and will continue to do a lot of good. And frankly, we have a lot of fiscal space to invest in longer term economic objectives in a way that actually we can do without reducing, without increasing the deficit.
Last thing to ask you about are the talks the president's been having with the Republicans' chief negotiator on infrastructure legislation. She's Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. We know they had a conversation again today. Is progress being made?
Well, the president and Senator Capito had a conversation this afternoon, and Senator Capito introduced some new ideas. But we're not at a place where the proposal that is on the table is something that is consistent with what the president believes we need to grow the economy, to sustain this economic growth, create good jobs, fight the climate crisis. So the president and Senator Capito agreed they'll speak again on Monday. He's going to keep reaching out and keep engaging, but we're not at a place where the proposal on the table is something that would work for the president.
Ah, so not enough yet. But finally, it's been reported that the president offered in their earlier meeting this week, instead of raising the corporate income tax, to establish a minimum corporate income tax. Is that something they're still talking about? Is the president looking at other compromises?
Well, the president's been raising in his conversations with Republicans a whole range of common sense ways to pay for these proposals. He remains committed to reforming the corporate tax code, including raising the corporate tax rate. But there are other elements of his plan, including the one you mentioned, to establish a minimum 15% rate that all corporations pay to try to address this issue that today there are dozens of Fortune 500 CEOs, profitable companies that pay zero in taxes. The other issue he raised was tax enforcement, not actually raising tax rates on anyone, but just making sure that high-income people and corporations pay the taxes that they already owe. These are ideas he thinks makes a lot of sense. He's continuing to raise them with Republicans, and we're hoping that these are the kind of areas that we could find common ground on.
We're going to leave it there. Brian Deese, who chairs the President's National Economic Council, thank you.
Thanks, Judy.
A surge in crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border in recent months has led U.S. border agents to drop some migrants off at sites in rural American towns to begin their wait for court hearings. As special correspondent Dan Lieberman reports, these towns often lack the means to cope with the influx, even though aid groups have stepped in to help.
Hola, buenas tardes.
It's another hot day on the border for Fernie Quiroz, a volunteer with the Arizona-California Humanitarian Coalition, a group that was created to respond to a growing trend, Border Patrol releasing migrants in small towns that lack the resources to respond.
They have nowhere to call, where to go. They don't even know where the bus station is at. Where's an airport? Where's a local hotel?
Instead of releasing the migrants onto the streets, Border Patrol began dropping them off at the Regional Center for Border Health in Somerton, a rural city near Yuma, Arizona, where they get COVID tested and are given food and water before boarding a charter bus to shelters hours away. From there, they often travel hundreds of miles to stay with family members or a sponsor.
The 41 individuals that were released to us today, this time tomorrow, they will be in the arms of their family.
The next day, we met C and her 9-year-old daughter from Nicaragua. For her own protection, we're just using her first initial. I asked her why she decided to leave now.
There is a lot of conflict. There's no economy. There's no work. There's no way to get ahead. Besides, we're afraid of being in a country where there is great danger for everyone.
Once they got to the U.S. border, they crossed between official ports of entry to get into the U.S.
The area where we crossed, the wall is there, but it's open. The wall isn't closed. There's an entryway.
We're right up against the border with Mexico, where just a small fence and canal separate the two countries. We were told by Customs and Border Protection that a majority of migrants are choosing to cross at places like this one instead of ports of entry. Under Title 42, the pandemic-era rule that expels most migrants, many know that if they cross here or other places like it and turn themselves into Border Patrol, they can claim asylum.
Customs and Border Protection say they've recently seen the highest number of apprehensions along the southwestern border in two decades, with nearly 180,000 in April alone, a 34% increase from the last surge in the spring of 2019.
When you see these rural drop-offs occur, what does that say about the system?
Well, it would say that the system is bogged down.
Robert Bouchel is a special operations supervisor with Border Patrol's Tucson sector. He points out that by law, Customs and Border Protection has to release migrant families within 72 hours of their arrival in the U.S. Unaccompanied children are transferred to a health and human services shelter until they can be connected with vetted family or sponsors.
We don't have facilities that are built to house these populations like family units. When it's time to transfer custody, let's say to ICE, if ICE is not able to take those folks into their custody, we really have no choice but to release them with a notice to appear.
Some end up paroled into the community and some end up in detention.
Alex Miller is an attorney with the Florence Project, a legal services organization that provides free counsel to migrants. She says while some, like C, are processed into the U.S., most are still being immediately expelled back to Mexico under a pandemic-era rule called Title 42. Initially implemented by President Trump, the Biden administration has continued the policy, which closes the border indefinitely to non-essential travel to stop the spread of COVID-19.
We see it applied differently to people from different geographical backgrounds or demographics. But for the most part, individuals and families from Central America tend to be returned to Mexico. And folks from further afield, from South America, end up getting put into normal immigration proceedings.
Some residents of this Arizona border community have been frustrated by the releases, seeing it as one more symbol of a broken immigration system.
If people don't see it as a crisis, it's probably because they haven't seen it.
John Boltz is a fifth-generation produce farmer in Yuma County who struggled to maintain a legal and reliable workforce.
Right now, the message is come cross any which way you can and seek asylum and we'll put you up in a hotel. That's odd. That's not a great way, and it just it makes Customs and Border Protection's work that much more difficult. What we would like to see is legal commerce at the border, legal traffic at the border, not the situation we have today.
He says many of his own workers, some of whom cross the border every day, are as frustrated as he is.
To legally immigrate into this country, if you want to work in agriculture, that takes months, years of applications, tens of thousands of dollars. So it can be frustrating to see somebody else getting a much easier path.
For Mario Juaregui, who owns a business in the nearby border city of San Luis, it's a question of taxpayer dollars.
What's next for those families? Where are they going? Who's going to be taking care of them? Who's going to be feeding them? Who's going to be the health care that they need to be receiving? This is going to put a tremendous burden on the American people.
Border Patrol acknowledges it presents challenges for the agency, too.
As Border Patrol agents, our job is to know who and what is coming across our borders between the ports of entry. And when we encounter large groups of children or family units, more of our resources that should be on the border looking for the who and the what's crossing are now diverted for a certain period of time to deal with those kids or those families that just entered.
Carlos Bernal, whose family emigrated from Mexico in 1972, believes the U.S. must welcome them.
Why do we have to deny them the universal right of the American dream? This land isn't owned by any individual person. It's everyone's land. We are all immigrants.
Well, I think we need to really talk about our small communities along the border.
Doug Nichols is the mayor of Yuma.
We really need to have a policy in place that protects them and that takes care of what the issues are on the release to not adversely affect the small communities where they need to transport to other communities when DHS is already present in those other communities. At the end of the day, this will just be a cycle that repeats itself if we don't get to the heart of the issues.
Alex Miller with the Florence Project agrees that the system needs to change.
One way to relieve some of the pressure on Border Patrol in rural areas is to make sure that migrants who want to seek asylum at ports have that opportunity.
After leaving Somerton, C and her daughter arrived safely at Casa Alitas, a shelter in Tucson, almost 4 hours from where we first met them. They were given a place to sleep, new clothes, and food before heading to the airport to fly to San Antonio to reunite with her brother, who she hasn't seen in 10 years. I asked her what her hopes are now.
I have to work so that my daughter can study. I want her to have a better future. I feel happy to have had the opportunity to come to this country.
If the Biden administration ends Title 42, as they just did with Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, aid groups and Border Patrol anticipate there will be a significant increase in the number of migrants crossing the border again. They're waiting to hear what comes next. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Dan Lieberman in Arizona.
There were no vigils in Hong Kong and certainly none in Beijing to mark this 32nd anniversary of the massacre in Tiananmen Square. The Chinese army killed hundreds, perhaps thousands, after weeks of democratic protest. But many Chinese, through government control of media and repression, know nothing of what happened that day. Nick Schifrin has a rare interview with a Chinese political dissident who says the fate of today's China was sealed in the events of 1989.
In downtown Beijing today, there is nothing to see. No mentioning of the day that changed China. No memorial for the dead. Only a quiet, secure Tiananmen Square. 32 years ago, for 7 weeks, students filled the square with revolutionary fervor. They demanded reforms to the Chinese Communist Party, or CCP. At first, they repelled an attempt to clear the square. But the next day, overwhelming military force. One man, however brave, could not prevent the inevitable. Soldiers fired at peaceful protesters. At least hundreds were killed.
I could never imagine that the army would open fire on the students. The shooting exposed what CCP had been telling us were all lies. I was really shocked and began my own independent thinking. June 4th sowed a seed of doubt in my heart.
Tsai Shia's heart used to have no doubt. She grew up in a revolutionary communist family. That's her on the right. Her father was a veteran army commander. And she says she was a true believer.
I believed the CCP wholeheartedly since I was young. Also, my parents were very strict about our upbringing, teaching us to have high moral standards, a pure heart, and not to become privileged kids.
By 1989, she was a rising star in the party. She lectured at a Communist Party school near Shanghai and witnessed a sanitized version of Tiananmen on Chinese TV.
At that time, the CCP denied that the army opened fire and that any student or resident was shot and killed. But I learned that not only bullets were fired at the Tiananmen Square, but also along the road, all the way leading to the square.
When did you learn that? How did you learn the truth?
I had stayed in Beijing since 1992. Every year around the anniversary of June 4th, people would talk about it. And I heard the stories bit by bit from the circle of friends.
By then, Tsai Shia had risen to the pinnacle of Communist Party education, the central party school in Beijing. We visited in 2019. Party leaders are educated here. The party's revered figures are immortalized in larger-than-life statues. And Xi Jinping was the school's president before he became party leader, military commander-in-chief, and Chinese president in 2012.
How concerned, how fearful, even today, are the leaders of the Communist Party if the population would learn the truth?
I think the CCP is concerned that if people knew about the truth of June 4th, it would lose the legitimacy of its rule, because the students were demanding democracy and to crack down on corruption. They were the voice for justice of the Chinese people. People were demanding basic human rights, so the CCP tried everything they could to cover up the truth.
While at the party school, Tsai Shia says for the first time she saw Chinese propaganda up close. That solidified the doubts she'd already been harboring, that a system she'd once considered sacred was actually a deceptive dictatorship.
My change of heart did not happen with one event or one book. It was a gradual process. When I was young, I was never told about love or humanitarianism. When I joined the army, I was assigned to take care of the library, where I read many Western classics. I read the book of the rise and fall of the Third Reich about Hitler. Later, I watched a video depicting Hitler's rally. It really shocked me. The scene and sound of the rally was so similar to that of the Cultural Revolution. I witnessed from the inside how the CCP actually operated and realized that their high-sounding narratives to the public were all deception.
In 2019, Tsai Shia came to the U.S. as a tourist. She got stuck here because of the pandemic, but she calls herself a dissident. She knows she cannot go home. In December 2020, she published an article in Foreign Affairs and wrote, "The ideas the party sanctimoniously promoted were in fact self-serving tools used to deceive the Chinese people." The Chinese Communist Party denounces and persecutes critics like Tsai Shia. It argues that by protecting the party, it's protecting the country. And the party says Chinese people's freedom comes from a country that's prosperous.
What the party says is that it is guaranteeing people's economic freedom, and that any threat to the party is actually a threat to the Chinese state. Can you respond to that?
They only implemented economic freedom in a limited way to create more wealth and collect more revenue for the government.
Tsai Shia says today's China was not inevitable. In the late 1970s and 80s, Deng Xiaoping called for reforms and political liberalization. Tsai Shia says that died in Tiananmen Square.
Opening fire on June 4th turned China back to the totalitarian state, and China lost the possibility of a peaceful transformation.
And today, Xi Jinping has centralized power even more.
Reports from below are made by guessing what the above would like to hear, and only reporting the good news. On the other hand, when a decision is made, everyone will agree and praise it. Therefore, Xi Jinping increasingly believes he is correct and is increasingly unable to listen to dissenting points of view. The CCP has deceived the American people and government for so many years. If it were not for the Wuhan virus that has spread throughout the world, people may still not see through the true nature of the CCP regime.
And that regime has ensured its true nature is invisible. in today's Beijing. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
And now to the analysis of Brooks and Capehart. That is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Hello to both of you on this Friday night. It's very good to see you, and there is a lot to talk about. David, let's start with where we are on these so-called infrastructure negotiations. Not sure that term tells us everything, but today we're hearing President Biden focus on the good news in the jobs report, but also we're learning that the talks with Republicans on the coming up with some sort of infrastructure compromise don't seem to be going anywhere. If they don't, David, is this all been a waste of time?
No, I don't think so. I think he's compromised a lot more than I thought he would. He's come down on the overall size of the package by $1 trillion. Republicans have only come up by $200 billion. He's compromised on what kind of taxes, a mix of taxes. He wants to make sure there are some corporate taxes, but is willing to bend on the original proposal. And I think he needs to do that. He needs to do that in part because there are a lot of moderate Democrats who are nervous by this bill. And even if Republicans and the Democrats don't eventually come to a deal, it strengthens his hand to go to Joe Manchin and other moderate Democrats and say, hey, I really tried. And if he wants to say, let's do this through reconciliation, a process by which they only need the Democratic votes, he's made a good faith effort. The fact is he's in a weak position. He's got 50 votes in the Senate and a small majority in the House. He's got to do this sort of thing. So I think he's doing it reasonably well.
Jonathan, is this something the president helps himself by doing, no matter how it turns out?
Absolutely, because he does need to show, particularly to Senator Manchin and Senator Kyrsten Sinema, that he's making a good faith effort at the bipartisanship that those two, and particularly Senator Manchin, say that they want. However, these talks and these negotiations and the back and forth, as you reported earlier, Judy, the president and Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia will be talking again on Monday. But as we learned last week, I believe it was, from Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Secretary of Transportation, that, and I'm looking down here, it's a fish or cut bait moment. And he was talking about that in terms of the week of June 7th, when Congress is back, and just in saying that, you know, we need a clear direction. And so I think after the phone call on Monday between the president and Senator Capito, we might get a clearer view of what that clear direction is and whether the president is going to fish or cut bait.
And it sounded like from listening to Brian Deese a little bit earlier tonight, who directs the president's Council of Economic Advisors, that right now the White House isn't seeing what they think amounts to something. But we will watch this space. Something else I very much want to ask both of you about are the assignments, David, that the president has given his vice president, Kamala Harris. You know, we don't hear from her very often. But the president's given her now several big assignments. One of them is dealing with the Central American countries that are sending so many migrants, or trying to send them. They're coming to the United States saying to her, we've got to stop this. We've got to at least cut back on the number who are trying to come to the U.S. And then separately, the very important assignment of working with these states where Republican legislatures are trying to cut back, restrict on voting rights. Is this something that the Vice President Harris, you know, she's got to do well on? I mean, how risky are these assignments that he's giving her, David?
Extremely. You know, she asked for the Democratic, the voting rights. She asked for that. So, and I give her credit for taking on something hard. It's essentially being asked, you know, on Monday, we'd like you to solve the Middle East peace problem. And on Tuesday, why does evil exist in the world? And Wednesday, why does consciousness arise from the brain? I mean, these are all extremely hard things. And I'm dubious that she can do much. She doesn't actually have much power over the border, as her aides have made clear. The odds stacked against some of the voting rights things in the Congress are pretty high. She doesn't have much control over this, what's going on in the states. The only thing I can think of for why she's agreed to take these assignments and why the administration wants her to do it is they want to turn up the public pressure on all of them. I don't think she has much control over what happens in state or federal legislatures, but she can turn on the public pressure and try to change public opinion. But that, too, is a tall order. So she is certainly taking lofty challenges.
And Jonathan, you've talked to her, you've interviewed her just in the last few days. How do you see all this? How does she see it?
Well, actually, I interviewed Vice President Harris a week ago today, and it was to talk about the 1 year since the murder of George Floyd and the 100 years since the Tulsa race massacre. And at the end of the interview, Judy, I asked her, is there a question that I didn't ask that you wish I had? And just give me the answer. And she shouted before I could finish, she said, voting rights. And then she went and talked about how, you know, our democracy is weaker when people are prevented from voting, and our democracy is stronger when everyone who can vote is allowed to vote. And then we find out a few days later, the president's assignment. Look, as David said, this is an assignment that she asked for after a meeting with civil rights leaders at the White House earlier. This is June, so early May. And having interviewed Vice President Harris before when she was a senator and when she was California Attorney General, this is something that she truly cares about. And so taking this on, in addition to the Northern Triangle, in addition to expanding broadband access, she is operating in the same mode, maybe even an enhanced mode in the vice presidency that President Biden did or acted when he was vice president to President Obama. The one thing he said to President Obama was, I want to be the last person in the room. And being 8 years in that position and now being president of the United States, having a governing partner with him, which he has in Vice President Harris, it seems like the president is unafraid to hand her one difficult task after another.
And it certainly, we are now focused on the fact that she has these assignments. So we will watch and see where it goes. I do want to turn you both to a couple of Republicans, prominent Republicans, who've been speaking out in the last few days about former President Trump. Last week, Paul Ryan, the former Speaker of the House, made a speech at the Reagan Library. Was pretty critical of President Trump, not by name, but said it's time for the Republican Party to stop focusing on personalities and focus on principle. And then you had, in the last few days, an interview given by President Reagan's, one of his chief strategists, who's still around in his 90s, a man named Stu Spencer. David lives in California. He gave an interview and said to the Los Angeles Times, and said it was very critical of President Trump, said he's doing bad, terrible damage to the Republican Party. But then the man who was President Trump's vice president, Mike Pence, gave a speech just last night in New Hampshire. And I'm just going to play a little bit of that for you and our audience.
You know, President Trump and I have spoken many times since we left office. And I don't know if we'll ever see eye to eye on that day.
So, David, he went on to say, but we are still very proud. I'm still very proud of everything we accomplished over 4 years. Taking these comments together, do we have any clearer picture of what's going on in the Republican Party?
Have we ever seen daylight between Pence and Trump before? I'm not sure we have. I think this may be the universe cracking in half. You know, I do think there's a pre-Trump Republican Party who all the gentlemen you just referenced to are members of. And they want it to be a conservative party. They don't want it to be a January 6th party. And they don't, frankly, want it to be a Trump party. And so they're trying to angle the party away from being a January 6th party. Trump rebutted, and he wants it to be a stolen election party. And what will happen? There are two sides of this argument. I think the regular Republicans, the establishment Republicans, are hoping that he sort of fades away. He's off Facebook for another 2 years. His blog has been closed for lack of interest. Maybe there's some fading away. And I think that's a plausible roadmap. I wouldn't bet on it, but you know, I suspect the Republicans will do pretty well in 2022. The out party tends to win these midterm elections. The Republicans control the maps in state after state. And so at the end of 2022, we may have a victory for the Republicans in the House and possibly even the Senate, which will be a non-Trump victory. And then the party might look different. I think that's a long shot, but I think Trump is really still the major force, and January 6th is still the major myth of the Republican Party. But if you're an establishment Republican That's what you'd be trying to do in the hope that you can gradually sideline this guy.
And Jonathan, how do you see what's going on in the Republican Party? And David's right. People are starting to talk about 2022.
Yeah, I think it's just what's happening in the Republican Party is sheer insanity. The fact that a January 6th commission couldn't even get approved by the Senate. But that's a whole other conversation. My concern about the Republican Party is you have these lofty speeches from Paul Ryan and Mike Pence. You have the principled actions of Congresswoman Liz Cheney. And yet the bulk of the party isn't with them. The bulk of the party is still with Donald Trump. The Republican Party can't seem to quit Donald Trump. And I would argue that the 2022 midterm elections, where, yeah, Democrats are in big trouble, at least in the House, in terms of maintaining the majority in the House, if the Republicans do indeed take the majority away from the Democrats in the midterm elections, I think they're going to learn the wrong lessons. And that Donald Trump, Facebook or no Facebook, and the people who follow him will take that as, see, our message works. This is what we need to do to go forward as a party. And I think that the Republican Party's, you know, journey in the wilderness will just be a lot longer, and it'll be a lot uglier for American politics as a result.
And David, I'm giving you the last word.
You know, it takes three election losses to really change a party, in my view. And Democrats keep messing up by allowing Republicans to win. And so, you know, if Democrats would nominate some conservative candidates in places like Georgia, Florida, and Ohio, they'd have a better chance of not relying on Joe Manchin. And so we'll see if they can do that. But if they can't do that, and if they nominate progressives in non-progressive places, then they get what they get.
And Jonathan, we're going to let you have your comeback on that next Friday.
All right, next Friday.
Next Friday, you've got a whole week. All right, Jonathan Capehart, David Brooks, thank you both.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you.
Good weekend, David.
The coronavirus toll on our lives in our country has been immense. In the past day, the number of deaths has passed 600,000. For the many families who've lost loved ones during this pandemic, the toll is greater still. We pause now to remember some of their lives. Patty Sakal was a lifeline for Hawaii's deaf community after the coronavirus hit. For months, the 62-year-old served as a sign language interpreter during state and city government pandemic briefings. Patty dedicated her life to ensuring deaf people were treated equitably and fully informed, her sister said. Growing up in Honolulu, Patty and her two siblings would interpret the nightly news for their parents, both of whom were deaf. Later in life, the mother of three and grandmother of two helped create a nonprofit that provided resources for Hawaii's deaf community, named in honor of her mother and father. Leslie Hagen Morgan loved his South Los Angeles community and worked to make it a better place. The 38-year-old husband and father of two ran a charter school, coached basketball, and helped to enroll struggling students in community college. Leslie was focused on connecting students with their purpose, away from gang violence, his wife told us. He leaves behind a food program he launched after noticing his students were struggling because they didn't have enough to eat. 52-year-old Daryl Toombs served as a critical care paramedic in New York for the past three decades. A husband and father of six, Daryl spent his life caring for others, often in their moments of greatest need. On the morning of September 11, 2001, Daryl and his wife were volunteering with a local ambulance crew when the first plane hit the World Trade Center. Daryl quickly assembled a team of paramedics and drove into the city to help. His wife said Daryl loved spending time with his family and seven grandchildren. Alicia Martinez was a first-generation college student determined to help people. The 21-year-old was working toward her master's in social work at Baylor University. She was kind, loved to paint and draw, and had helped start a reading program for young students in her hometown of Waco, Texas, her father said. After her passing, Alicia's parents accepted her diploma during Baylor's graduation ceremony this spring. Donnell Cobbins Jr., a fourth-generation minister, was born and raised in South Memphis. Donnell, a father of two, served as a pastor at St. Luke Missionary Church in the same neighborhood where he grew up. People gravitated toward him, and he gravitated toward people, Donnell's younger brother told us. He was known as a role model, exceptionally bright and always curious. When the pandemic began, Donnell applied for a grant to keep church services going virtually. Shortly after his passing, the church received the funding, a gift he leaves behind. Donnell was 49 years old.
And we are so grateful to family members for sharing these stories. Our hearts go out to you, as they do to everyone who's lost a loved one in this pandemic.
I am happy to say that this is a good news story. Do not be fooled by the zombie massacre. The NewsHour's Mike Melia checks in on the latest work by two budding filmmakers he's been tracking for years. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Now he rides like a bike.
There are moments in life you do not forget. For me, one of them is when I first met Sam Suckman and Maddie Zufelt. I had no idea that October day back in 2014 in Providence, Rhode Island, would be an invitation to come along on an epic adventure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
As we will discover, it appears Sam knew it all along.
My whole life, I feel like I never fit in anywhere or have a voice. But someday, that will change. I'll be somebody, and that day is today.
The NewsHour was profiling Sam and his best friend, Maddie, because they had an inspiring Kickstarter to fund their dream of creating a zombie movie. And that is exactly what they did. They rounded up family, friends, and film professionals to pull it all off. But they were the driving creative forces, from writing the script to playing the lead roles. Jesse Suckman is Sam's older brother.
Our idea was to do their idea. And that infectious energy is what got us in, but I think that their confidence gave us the confidence to ask the next layer of people, and it was that same Sam and Maddie confidence that gave that next layer of people the confidence to ask it. If any of us were doing this for ourselves, we probably wouldn't have gone as hard for it, but I think Sam and Maddie's determination and like unwillingness to compromise in the service of this big party, it gives everybody just an extra jolt of energy to pull off the impossible. And I think that was all Bobby and I had to do is sort of just commit. We're like, yeah, we're going to do it. And it's just been this insane rolling party adventure since then.
Open on the skyline of downtown Providence.
Bobby Carnival is Jesse's friend, professional filmmaker, and director.
Thinking back on that Kickstarter video, it was like, we didn't really do, I mean, there was like definitely some zombie movie talk, but it was just like Sam and Maddie like engaging with the camera and us and like us driving around. We just did like a day with them. Like, okay, then at 3 o'clock we go and get slushies at Cumberland Farms. And we're like, all right. And just like every step of the way, even on the way to the Cumberland Farms, was like a whole trip. And I think that was like my first insight to just like, wow, like they have so much to say and so much energy. And the way that the two of them bounce off each other as these like best friends, and they both have their own little like quirks and like dynamics, and Maddie's outrageous, Sam's like emotional, and it just this little tag team, and we just kind of like slipped right in there.
An ambitious new project.
After our initial profile, the spotlight on Sam and Maddie came fast and furious.
Two New England teens are breaking barriers, trying to make it big in Hollywood,
aspiring to be the next big filmmakers from Rhode Island.
From local news features to national profiles, including CBS Sunday Morning.
I don't do it for fame. I do it because I love it, you know, because...
I'm doing it for the money.
You're doing it for the money?
Yeah.
Well, I do it because I love it.
Have you gotten rich on this so far?
Not yet.
They were even guests on Conan O'Brien.
What I love about what you guys have done is you met years ago, you talked about this dream, yeah, and you made it happen. Here we are all these years later, and you made your zombie movie, yes, and you had a premiere that the press attended. Everyone loves the movie, and then you fly out here to come on our show. Yes, this course is pretty spectacular.
But they never let the spotlight blind them to who they were. Sam and Maddie told Conan they needed a chocolate fountain, and they got it. In the movie, they wanted a slew of celebrity cameos. They didn't get The Rock, but...
Yeah, we have a lot of people this morning.
And not Bieber. No Bieber. He's crazy in the head.
One celebrity on the top of their list, the Jersey Shore's DJ Pauly D. And he is in. Spoiler alert, in the movie's climactic fight scene, DJ Pauly D kills me by throwing a record in my head. Now, in a new documentary streaming on Apple Plus, you can see Spring Break Zombie Massacre while witnessing the journey behind the camera.
They made a really good movie. I love this movie. I love watching it. You watch this movie with a smile on your face the whole time. And somebody asked me, they said, yeah, but do you think they wanted you to have a smile on their face? I said, absolutely. This isn't the, you know, this isn't The Walking Dead. This is Zombieland. They wanted to entertain. And it's totally entertaining.
Peter Farrelly, Academy Award-winning director of Green Book, also behind comedy classics like Dumb and Dumber and Something About Mary, was executive producer of Sam and Maddie Make a Zombie Movie.
I promise you I will know them till the end of my life, and I hope they make more movies, and I know they will, because they're those kind of guys. This isn't a one-off for them. They're not just coming in and saying, hey, we're going to make a movie, and now we'll move on and build an airplane. They're going to make movies. They're really good at it.
How do Sam and Maddie see it?
So doing it with this guy right here, you know, as I know since childhood, you know, is also really amazing too, because this guy is the best guy in the world right here.
Yeah.
They knew if they were going to pull this off, they needed to be in the driver's seat.
I had the vision, and Maddie tagged along with the vision and made it bigger. It's like a blueprint, right? So like I really put in the work to make the blueprint in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. And sat down and did it. Maddie came up with all these crazy ideas and architecture to it in a way.
Yeah.
For both like the architectures of it. So it's really cool.
Turns out, the true story has nothing to do with jetpacks or fighting zombies. Behind the gore is a lesson in love.
This whole thing was an excuse to hang out, and it was a reason to hang out, and it was a way to hang out that broke down so many barriers that he faces every day. You know, without this giant zombie movie, what would we have done all together? How would I have gotten all my friends from New York here? He knew that it was this vision that was bringing people. They were coming for the zombie movie and they were staying because we were all becoming really close friends. And he built a family through a horrifying, violent, insane zombie movie. And he's a genius.
Sam and Maddie are both now 25.
It's not safe here. We can hang out here.
They're looking for their next gig and hoping to find a funder for a sequel.
We're making a sequel.
Mostly a lot more Sam and Maddie adventures on the way too. You know what I mean?
Sam, Maddie, let's go, bros.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Mike Melia.
And how is that not a fabulous way to end the week? Thank you, Mike Melia. It's completely changed my taste in movies. I now like zombie movies. Sam and Maddie Make a Zombie Movie is streaming now on Apple Plus. And on that note, that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a good weekend. Thank you for watching, and please stay safe.